Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. I am delighted to be talking to Rebecca Giggs tonight about her extraordinary debut, Fathoms, The World and the Whale. Rebecca's book understands and respects the deep connection between the natural world and the people who inhabit it. And I want to acknowledge the traditional owners and storytellers of the land that I'm speaking to you from. This is the land of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung people and their elders past and present. Rebecca is joining us down south from Canberra, Ngunnawal country, and I pay my respects to their elders as well. This land was never ceded and always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Rebecca is a writer from Perth, Western Australia. Fathoms has been published here in Australia, in the United Kingdom and in the United States. It was the winner of the Nib Literary Award, a finalist for the Kirkus Prize for Nonfiction, and the winner of the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Nonfiction. It's also on the shortlist for the Stella Prize. So many critics have just absolutely tripped over themselves to try and articulate the power and the wonder of this book, but my favourite is by Robert Moore, who calls it a work of bright and careful genius. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks so much, Michaela, for that generous introduction. It's wonderful to be with you.
So part of the magic of this book is your beautiful prose, and rather than attempt to do justice to us myself, I wonder if you could kick us off by reading an excerpt from the beginning of the book where you describe a whale fall.
Sure. So a whale fall is this process whereby a dead whale that dies in the open ocean slowly filters down through the water column, and it's kind of attacked by all these decomposers and predators during its descent. So this is from the preface of the book. The dead whale slips below the depth where epipelagic foragers can feed from it. The whale's mushy body decelerates as it drops, and where pressure compounds, putrefying gases build up in its softening tissues. It drifts past fish that no longer look like anything we might call fish, but resemble instead bottled fireworks, reticulated rigging, and musical instruments turned inside out. The whale enters the abyssopelagic zone. No light has ever shone here for so long as the world has had water. Entering permanent darkness, the whale passes beyond the range of diurnal time. Purblind hagfish slink, jawless, pale as the liberated internal organs of other animals. Jellyfish tie themselves into knots. The only sound is the scrunch of unseen brittle stars eating one another alive. Slowly, it is very cold. Hell's gelid analog on Earth. The hagfish rise to meet the carcass and they tunnel in, lathering the passages they make with mucus. The whale body reaches a point where the buoyancy of its meat and organs is only tethered by the force of its falling bones. Later, it falls quickly to the seafloor, into the plush cemetery of worms that have accrued below. Gusts of billowing silt roll away. The body is likely to settle far deeper than any living whale will ever descend to see it. Now rat tails, sea scuds, more polychaetes and eel pouts appear. No one knows where they come from. Opportunist octopuses bunt between ribs. Sightless, whiskered troglodytes like ginger tubers burrow into the surrounding sediment, which is blackened with fat and whale oil. From the dark come red streamer creatures that flutter all over. Colourless crabs, their delicate gluttony. Life pops. It's as though the whale were a piñata, cracked open, flinging bright treasures. Over 200 different species can occupy the frame of one whale carcass. Then there is the otter sax, a pink plumed tube that shrinks back into the Gothic column of its name, Latin for bone devourer. This mouthless, gutless worm is nonetheless insatiable. It eats through its feet, which extend like trickling roots into the marrow. The remaining bones of the dead whale on the seafloor are stripped and hollowed, and then they fluff up with flounces of silver-white bacteria so that it appears as if the skeleton is draped in meters of downy toweling. There the bones stay, lashed softly by microbes. Decades may pass, 100 years even, before nothing remains. Only a dent that holds the dark darker.
Thank you so much. It's just such astonishingly wonderful writing.
Just before we continue, I'll note that for those of you who are joining us tonight, if you'd like to ask a question of Rebecca, you can do that by the Q&A function, which is down at the bottom of your screen. I'll sift through those towards the end of this conversation, and it would be really great to hear from all the people who are joining us from wherever they may be this evening. So this book is filled with so much haunting imagery, and reading it, I felt a little like I was swimming through the text, which I'm sure many people have made that really original comparison before, but it really was as though I had to take a big breath before each paragraph and then continue to dive down as you led your readers very adeptly into the depths. One of the images that has really stayed with me is the whale that was found on the Spanish coast with an entire greenhouse in its stomach. Can you tell us about that whale and what this discovery sparked in your thinking?
Yeah, so this whale didn't beach alive, it died, and then it washed up on the coast south of Granada in Spain, not far from Almeria, the greenhouse district of Spain, where it's sort of famously known as the salad bowl of Europe, where a lot of salad vegetables are grown through the wintertime. And biologists wanted to understand how it had met its end, so they did a necropsy on it. Humans have an autopsy and animals have a necropsy. And in the course of their examination, they opened its stomach and they found this stupendous medley of weird objects. They found coat hangers. They found bits of a mattress, an ice cream tub. But most surprisingly to me, they found an entire greenhouse. So all the tarpaulins and flower pots and ropes and burlap, it had all been kind of rolled up into this heap. And this whale had ended up with it in its stomach. And I think, you know, my initial questions on reading this in a scientific paper, you know, was the bamboozlement of how does a greenhouse even get between a whale and its world? You know, how does that synthetic object end up so large out in the ocean? How does a whale actually physically swallow a greenhouse? But the other part of it that obviously stood out to me was its resonance with metaphor, because of course, you know, we have these stories in our culture of whales turning up full of people, you know, if that's a biblical story or if it's the tall tales of old salt fishermen in lots of cultures, there are stories of whales turning up with humans inside them, and that's a moral moment. And then on the other hand, you know, here is this icon of the 1980s environmental movement, the Save the Whales movement, and it's consuming the metaphor that we use to talk about climate crisis, like the greenhouse effect. And I read this paper thinking like the scientists have just really missed the opportunity for the chance to dig into this symbol, you know, this collision between 1980s idealism and environmentalism and the global change currents that we're experiencing today. So honestly, that was the sort of start point for the book. Earlier in the chapter, this preface that I've just read for you, I describe encountering a stranded whale in Perth. But I had thought that might be an interesting anecdote for an essay or perhaps even for a short story. And it wasn't until I read about the Spanish sperm whale that I actually had sort of the moment of thinking, this is a narrative nonfiction book. Yeah, so it was really the point of instigation for the book.
That a whale has swallowed an entire greenhouse is such a blaring indictment on our relationship between humans and the planet. But when you encountered that stranded whale in Perth, some of the people that you spoke to on the beach had quite different ideas about what had brought the whale to shore, sort of like almost astrophysical ideas about what had prompted it. Could you tell us a bit about some of those views and what you think prompted them?
Yeah, so this was some years ago. This is a different whale. It was a yearling humpback that had stranded not far from my home in Perth. A yearling's not a massive whale. It was about 12 metres long. And of course, you know, it had drawn down a great crowd of people to see it. People brought their children, people brought their pets. And, you know, it was this sort of tragic but also carnivalesque moment, a sort of macabre moment, because, of course, the whale had stranded so concertedly that it was going to die. It was inevitable that it was going to die. And yet, you know, there was such excitement to encounter this huge animal from the depths of the ocean. And people in the audience, in the crowd, all had really different theories for why this whale had come aground. Some people thought it had been chased by sharks or killer whales and predators. Some people said to me, it must be malnourished. You know, maybe its mother didn't feed it well as a calf. Others thought it might have something to do with Japanese whaling or climate change. And one man even said to me that he understood that whale beachings were connected to falling stars. Although we sort of talked about it at the time and neither of us could really pin down, you know, was that because they navigate by the stars or did they get confused when there's like additional light in the sky at nighttime? Yeah, they were all really fascinating theories. And actually part of the book's project was to treat each of them seriously and to really think about, you know, okay, so what is the connection between plastic pollution or climate change and the life that a whale leads now? And interestingly, there are actually some kind of connections between whale beachings and astrological phenomena. But it's not that the whales are responding to falling stars. It's that what causes aurora in the sky, a shift in the Earth's magnetism responding to the weather on the face of the sun, that shift in magnetism can also subtly distort their ways of navigating in the deep sea without any landmarks. They have magnetic kind of senses, some of them. And if they are, you know, sent off course by these solar storms that also cause the aurora, they can sometimes strand.
Those connections that you explore and tease out are just infestiminal in this book and so surprising. Like I just never considered beyond the really obvious effect of whaling in the Galapagos Islands, where you mentioned that the ships that came to ground brought rats from the other side of the world that then completely pillaged that population that wasn't designed to deal with these new predators. So yeah, on almost every page, I was finding some new surprising fact like that. But can you tell us a little bit about the ways that whales are connected to us in ways that are difficult for us to imagine, but have the gravest of importance to them? What are some of the more surprising connections that you found?
Surprising connections. That's a good question. You know, the most revelatory piece of science that came out of the research for this book has to do with the way in which whales affect the chemical composition of the atmosphere. And, you know, this sounds like such an abstract idea because when I started the project, I understood whales as marine creatures. You know, they participate in marine food webs. They, you know, they decompose in the seafloor. I had no idea that actually their lives were so pivotally connected to the changes in the atmosphere. And the reason that is because how they feed and where they feed affects the growth of plankton. Plankton are plant-like organisms, single cellular or very small, but they are the base of food pyramids in the ocean. And they also emit oxygen on a planetary scale, the larger contributor to the offset of carbon dioxide than the rainforests are, in fact. And what happens is whales, these huge marine predators, they pursue squid or krill or copepods, whatever it is their species is eating. And they tend to do that at depth. So they feed down at depth, but they don't defecate down there. So basically their bodies are under pressure. And when they come up, they excrete and they leave these like fecal plumes in the water that are bright orange color because they eat bright orange krill. And that's kind of like the manure that fertilizes plankton. So there's this kind of like pump action that's going on where whales are drawing nutrients from the deep sea up to the lighter layers where it can be utilized by these photosynthesizing organisms. And, you know, there have been studies done to show that ultimately that means that a single whale has the same kind of climate effect as 1,000 trees. And there are even some people who advocate for including the preservation of whales in the Paris Accord now, because there have been studies to show that increasing the productivity of plankton by just 1% would be the equivalent of introducing 2 billion mature trees into the planet's ecosystem. So if you can keep that ecological function going and you can keep plankton growing, then, you know, we've got a really healthy system. So that was really surprising to think about that sort of connection of whales to the atmosphere. Yeah, I mean, in terms of our connection to whales, you know, from the kind of coastal ecologies, people's kind of connection to whales, sadly, you know, the most dramatic study, I think, was some of the stuff on heavy metal pollution, mm-hmm. where some of the chemicals that we used to use on agriculture or even in the course of urban development have washed out into the ocean and they collect in the bodies of whales, making them very polluted. Yeah, I had no idea that sort of lingering effects of the persistent pollution could have gathered inside animal bodies and ended up like not just polluting the ocean, but polluting these creatures.
It's so interesting to consider how you point out in the 19th century, the world was hugely populated by products made of whale. And now in the 21st century, it's sort of the reverse. Like whales are filled with our plastic debris and garbage. Can you tell us a bit about some other big changes that have affected the ways that whales live their lives today, whether that's sonically or chemically or ecologically?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I really remember the bumper stickers that said, save the whales. and I figured, you know, whales had kind of been saved. And it is important to note that the populations of the humpback whales and sperm whales are increasing. You know, humpbacks off the East Coast are having a baby boom. Sperm whales are off the endangered red list at last. But the ocean they live in is fundamentally changed. The ocean is a 21st century ocean, and it's accrued all of the dross from our culture, you know, be that in the form of litter or pollutants, or be it the result of kind of sonic change. Yeah, so, you know, the effects of shipping, the effects of underwater infrastructure, and then chemical change as well in the climate system, because the oceans are becoming minutely more acidic over time and because of their absorption of carbon dioxide. And this is affecting whales in lots of unexpected ways. One story I'll briefly mention is that the voices of blue whales have decreased the equivalent of 3 white notes on a piano since the 1960s. And that story may be a positive news story, or it may be a negative news story. We're still working that out. So the reason they're singing lowly, because they're singing more deeply, because they're singing more quietly. And that could be that there are simply more whales in the sea and they don't have to shout as loud to kind of reach one another. That's a positive conservation story. Or it could be that because of the acidity in the ocean, it makes the ocean a better medium for the carriage of sound. And they may not need to be quite so loud for their voices to carry over the same distance. But that means every sound in the ocean is kind of getting louder. Have you been whale watching, McKenna? Have you seen a whale?
Haven't. I really would love to now, but no, haven't had the pleasure.
Yes, you must.
You mentioned that you're a child of the 80s, and it's really apparent how much reverence you hold for these creatures throughout the course of this book. Can you tell us a bit about, like, I mean, the way that you empathize with that whale suffering on the beach is actually almost excruciating to read, but was it equally as excruciating for you in particular to visit the whaling ships in Japan? How was that experience for you?
I didn't want to go to Japan and write something that was sort of poorly culturally voyeuristic, right? I wanted to understand what the Japanese mind, like just how a different form of connection to whales had developed across history. So where we have kind of deified them and considered them very charismatic animals, the Japanese have obviously had whale as a cornerstone of cuisine. But interestingly, I thought maybe I would discover that actually they thought of whales in the same way we think of any seafood, like salmon or oysters. But that's not the case. It's just that there's a different set of stories that have accrued around what the whale represents in Japan. It's much more to do with national resilience and recovery after the Second World War, when the Japanese agricultural sector was completely decimated. They were encouraged by the Americans to go into Antarctic whaling, pelagic whaling, to provide a source of protein for people who'd really, you know, been crippled by the war. Yeah, and it kind of made me look back on my own kind of connection to the whale and how much that's sustained by story, not by any kind of fact, you know. And it was confronting. You know, I went down to Shimonoseki where the whaling ships come in and had a conversation with a few of the whalers there. They offered me a bowl of whale soup with a bit of minke in it.
Which you politely tried.
I politely tried, you know, after 7 years of being a vegetarian, that was a confronting moment. But I sort of had a taste of it and then said, it's not for me. And it was then passed on to the grandchildren of one of the whalers. I mean, it was a challenging research undertaking, but I was also pretty green at that point. Like I kind of waded in without, I didn't have a fixer or even a really good translator with me. And I think to some extent, you know, that kind of, I was lucky to go in with a bit of an experience at that point, because it just kind of, I didn't know that I could, you know, I couldn't ask for an interview, or I needed to go through channels, or I just kind of arrived.
I want to ask you a little bit now, changing tack a bit, about what you describe as the impulse for violent tenderness. You could either tell us about it, or if you'd like to, perhaps you could read a little bit from the start of the chapter titled Charisma.
Shall I read? Maybe I'll just tell you the story.
Yeah, sure.
A few years ago, off the coast of Buenos Aires, on a beach in Santa Teresita, a dolphin washed up. Dolphins are related to whales. They're from the same family. It was a particularly rare and endangered species of dolphin, and it was also a baby. And the crowd descended, down to see it, and they took a series of photos, selfies. So they handed the dolphin around, and in the course of handing it around and sort of taking these very cute images, the dolphin died. You know, I heard about this news story through some tabloid media, in fact, some really kind of aggressive reporting. And the images are quite confronting to look at, because you have this large crowd, and many of them are children, you know, like coming up to this animal and sort of with this mixture of glee and dread and trepidatiously like wipe, you know, kids don't really know that they're hurting something like that. You know, there's a kid with his hand over the blowhole at a certain point. I sort of got interested in this feeling, which actually I think has a lot to do with the lack of there being a kind of proper protocol to grieve environmental loss, you know, loss of biomes, loss of species. That has to do with kind of wanting to really demonstrate to other people a personal connection to nature, to the natural world, through this kind of like image-based culture. So the sort of selfies with cute animals, or the sort of very carefully cropped image where you're actually in a national park that's got hundreds of people walking around, but you've managed to frame it up to make it look as though you are the individual, you know, on the
we've all mountain. Tried to take those photos.
So I wanted to kind of like ask questions about the crowd and nature. And I think a lot of nature writing in the 21st century has been premised on a model of a sort of witnessing, adventuring individual. It's often white, masculine, able-bodied individual. The effects of the digital world on what we seek from nature, I think, has gone unaddressed in the context of nature writing as a genre. I kind of use these images as a springboard for thinking through those things, for asking questions about this emergent online emotion that's called cute aggression, the feeling that something is so cute we just can't stand it, you know, that sort of thin line between adoration and violence. I read some fascinating studies where Yale researchers showed people cute and cuter animal photographs, and they gave them bubble wrap to pop when they to mash in their fists as they were looking at these images. And I guess in a broader sense, I'm interested in that question of like where our love of nature is self-serving and where it, you know, has a kind of higher goal. But the dolphin photos, yeah, they were a challenge to look at. And the trick of that chapter was really sitting with them and trying to give some generosity to, because I actually don't think those people would have done that if they knew exactly, or if the crowd wasn't there.
I mean, what do you think this tendency reflects about humans and animals in the modern age and about our natural and digital environments? Where do you think we go from here? Is there an appropriate grieving process for this mass ecological extinction?
Yeah, I mean, that's a 10-ton question, right? I was having a really good chat with Laura Jean McKay, actually, a few months ago. Laura has a book that's on the Stella shortlist called The Animals in That Country, where she is really setting herself the project of asking what the limits of empathy are with other species. How do we understand like the embodied reality of other species? And I think that what both books are doing, although, you know, Laura's working in fiction and she's also working in a speculative future, whereas Fathoms is sort of very present tense and nonfiction, but both are kind of interested in the ways in which the sensitivities of animals open us up to other worlds and other kinds of harm as well. You know, the environmental moment we're living in, we're not just creating it and experiencing it, it's being metabolized by other species through their sensory realities. And so understanding from a scientific perspective how a whale hears or how a whale sees is also sensitizing us to its experience of environmental change. And I hope that the project is not to focus so much on animal extinction, much more focus on what is the ethics of what the animal experience is now, and what do we owe animals in the wild? What kind of life do we want to ensure for them? And then what kind of services do they provide for the environment? Like, what's the kind of like ecological role of that animal? Why might that mean we need to preserve more than just a kind of baseline, you know, pocket of certain number of animals that say, oh, well, the species is not extinct because there's a handful of them here. Like, that's not enough. So where do we go from here? I think that we're in a really interesting psychological moment. I think that there will be protocols to grieve loss, environmental loss, that emerge soon. I think that different forms of activism around that are helping. But this is where literature can really lead the conversation, you know, because it's not just the sciences that need to reckon with this. It's literary communities as well, and it's readers.
You said that you went into this very open-mindedly, and I think that's really apparent throughout the entire book. Was there an instance where your mind was changed by someone that you spoke to or something that you uncovered? Is there anything that springs to mind where...
Very early on in the research, I took a whale-watching trip. I went on an ecotourism whale-watching trip down off the coast of Eden, and I was excited to kind of come within arm's length of the animal in its own habitat. And we went out and we saw these humpbacks leaping on the horizon. But while we were watching them, this mother and calf pair came in underneath the boat. So they were really close. There was like distance of maybe half a tennis court between us and the whale. And the mother, who was trying to protect her calf, kind of got between the boat and the calf, and she came right up against the edge of the boat, and she rolled under the water. And I swear, like, there was this moment where I really felt like she was looking at me. Like, I really felt like this eye-to-eye contact. And I had that sort of ecstatic feeling of like, oh my goodness, I've been beheld as, like, you know, not just a part of the background, but something significant, as something being communicated in this moment. Then, of course, I spoke to scientists about the nature of whale vision and learned that actually there's no way that she could have possibly even seen me, let alone fitted me, you know, to her world. And while they do sometimes approach boats, you know, for different reasons, it was almost narcissistic, my attempt to personify her and to give her a character and to want to kind of fall into her eye line. And so, yeah, I really had to eat a bit of humble pie learning about whale vision to that extent.
So it's apparent that so much research has gone into this book, years and years and years and years. And I'm sorry if this is traumatizing you, to remind you how much work went into this. But can you tell us where and when you began, and then how you knew when you were finished?
I've asked that question of other journalists, right? At a certain point, I've been like, am I finished? How do you know when you're done? What's the signal? Where it began? The book began with that whale beaching off the coast of Perth. I had a notebook with me, and I took some sort of verbatim material down then. But I played around for it for a long time until I found this story of the Spanish sperm whale, which was the second kind of incident, at which point I realized that actually it needed to be a narrative nonfiction book. But it still then was quite a modest proposal. It was going to be really short. It was certainly not going to be, you know, the full-length book that it is now, or a six-year project, which is what it ended up being. How did I know I was finished? I think, you know, there's a patch in the research where something serendipitous happens, right? Where you are interviewing somebody or you're reading a scientific paper and the person you're interviewing says, you know who you should talk to? And then they name the person that you spoke to last night. Or you're reading the scientific paper and the footnotes show everything you've already read. And so you find yourself kind of like coming back over material. There's a circuit that's being made. Probably if you stuck at it with it longer, you'd create like another circuit of information that was broader and more kind of expansive. But once you hit that circular, that reiteration, then I think you know the research is done. and then it's just a process of like working with your editors as to when the manuscript is actually done. I thought it was done at a certain point, and then we went back in for another round of edits because the Americans, yeah, had a slightly different emotional temperature that they were interested in drawing more to the surface in the book. It was a process. It was a process.
Just in the Q&A, Nick has also commented on the astounding amount of research and has asked just practically, were you working another job while you wrote it? And how did you carve the mental space in your life to put this beautiful book together?
Yeah, I was working another job, a couple of different jobs across the course of writing the book, but I was employed full time at a university until February 2019. I did have a 6-month residency in 2018, which made all the difference. Like having a paid residency, this was overseas, being able to dedicate myself full time to the book in the last dash, what was the last dash until we got another round of edits. Yeah, that was extraordinarily important. Otherwise, I worked in the mornings a lot. I used to have a habit. I'm not so much a morning person now, but when I was in the thick of writing this, I would get up day one, I'd get up at 7:30, day two, I'd get up at 6:30, day three, I'd get up at 5:30, day four, I'd get up at 4:30, and then I'd sleep on day five. But it gave me an extra, each morning was an extra hour, you know, like you buy an extra hour. And then I have, my research initially was quite scattershot and notes were sort of hard to keep a record of, but I realized at a certain point that I needed to organize my research quite schematically. So I have like a cover sheet that sits on top of every live draft of the chapter, and that's kind of broken into two sections. It has what do you need to know and what does the reader need to know? Because often your research, you need to know actually a lot deeper than what ends up in the chapter. And what does the reader need to know? Well, you know, to give an example, like most readers would be familiar with the word blubber, but they might need a little primer again on like, you know, blubber is the subcutaneous fat that whales use to maintain a constant inner temperature. So that was a living document on the top of each chapter that is kind of scaffolding your research. I actually think it benefited from having a really long period of time, even though I would have appreciated more of a sprint. I think I would have. Yeah, it allowed the manuscript to morph across a long period. And really, you know, I also took two 6-month breaks, which were necessary to kind of grow some consciousness around what I was doing and why it mattered. Mm-hmm. So there were also some periods of time where I didn't work on the book at all.
Just on craft, while we're here, Warren has asked a bit of a question about the writing and the researching as well. So I just want to find out on his behalf, were you writing and researching at the same time, or was there a very clear, distinct research process and then you began the draft?
No, I write and research at the same time. What I tend to do is start with the scenes. In this kind of writing, there's always sections that are, you know, there's a kind of active narrator, me, going around doing a thing, seeing a thing, talking to somebody. So the stranded whale on the beach or an interview with an expert on animal charisma. I start with writing those scenes. They tend to suggest research questions. So I need to know more about how does a greenhouse end up in the ocean? So I've got to go away and learn something about oceanic plastic. But then at a certain point where the manuscript's maybe 60% done, you have to kind of zoom out and do this very global research check, because you don't want to have cherry-picked the information to serve your argument. There's a kind of process where you suddenly take a more high-altitude perspective and make sure that you've kind of considered counter-evidence and that you're not kind of pulling all the facts into line with a story or an argument you want to make that can't be supported by the evidence. And then, I mean, but even since finishing the book, there have been so many interesting whale-related news stories and scientific papers that have come out. And now I have to kind of like plug my ears so that I don't have the sort of like fear of, oh my God, I finished it and it didn't include this fact or it didn't include that fact. And I also had a very sophisticated system of Google alerts that, you know, if anyone's in the trenches with their narrative nonfiction book, chat to me about how you can make the research come to you.
And as part of your non-whale research, which books and authors did you look to in regards to the style and the genre that you hope to emulate? Did you have particular touchstones along the way?
Different books at different points. You know, the titans of the genre are, oh gosh, you know, Helen MacDonald or James Hamilton Patterson is a brilliant writer about the oceans. And there were times where I was really stuck with something structural or craft-based that I had to look to other books. One I will mention is The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmund Duval. It's not a it's not a nature writing book, it's a family memoir, but it's a really good example of a book with just beautiful bones. I really learned from reading that book, like simple things like how do you get out of the first chapter? Like after you've done the roadmap to the book, how do you transition from that into chapter two? I really credit that book with some amazing structural lessons. But yeah, I mean, I'm a really omnivorous reader. I read across fiction, poetry, and nonfiction. You know, Rob Moore's On Trails as well was a really helpful book. Yeah, that's just a handful.
Got a question from Lisa here about what we were talking about a little bit earlier about thoughts on dignity protocols for grieving loss of a species, and the selfie culture reminds us as humans of our fight as humans for the right to die with dignity. She asks, how can we communicate a parallel here to garner positive change?
Gosh.
Another 10-ton question for you just to...
No, that's absolutely. I was just listening to a podcast with an author of a book on the right to die that's coming out very soon. What is her name? I think that's an interesting comparison to make. I suspect that those two public policy issues are going to articulate quite differently because of the different kinds of, you know, stake that people have in those conversations. In terms of, you know, new protocols to grieve, how one finds a kind of like public conversation around that is really interesting. I mean, you know, the digital space is proving to be an environment in which people can stage these conversations as well as fuel, you know, certain kinds of, you know, in the case of selfie worship, destructive behavior as well. So that's a slant-wise question, but a really interesting connection to draw. Thanks to the listener for that one.
So now that I've drawn you out about all the really disturbing images and information in your book, I'd love for you to talk about the note of hope that I think underpins it all. And this is a question that came from the expert reading guide that Associate Professor Sarah Wills very generously asked the book club to consider as they read your book. But I want to flip it around and ask, what in the course of writing this book moved you to respond with hope towards the future rather than despair?
Fathoms is interested in the whale as a kind of Trojan horse for thinking about global change. To be anti-whaling in the 80s meant just being anti-whaling governments and anti-whaling fleets politically. Whereas to be for saving the whale today knits us together in this system of worldliness that extends, you know, all the way from the decision to buy wintertime tomatoes in a British supermarket that have been fostered under plastic in Almeria into the stomach of a sperm whale, which swallows the greenhouse that the tomatoes were growing in. There are these sort of bewildering chains of connection. And I think for some people that can feel kind of humiliating, like that what I do here in my kitchen or some small decision I've made has resulted in some harm to something so stupendous as a whale or remote as a whale. But actually what I took from that is that we have all got a capacity to make small changes, incremental changes locally that can prevent harm in, you know, nature on its most grandest dimensions. And I think like ultimately a whale is not just a wonder because it's the biggest animal on the face of the planet, but because it kind of, it's equipment for our moral imagination. It enables us to kind of like think about how we have responsibility for things that may not be within our immediate sphere of action or our day-to-day, but are still really within our sphere of influence. And as we face a, you know, tumultuous future environmentally and socially, I think we're going to be called to extend our compassion to a whole host of different entities, organisms, people that might seem really remote to us. So, you know, be that those people who are already suffering as a result of saltwater incursion on their properties in along the equator or storm surges, be that future generations, be that animals in far-flung wilderness. I think we need mental models for learning how to feel compassion for the unmet thing. And that's what whales give us. We are able to care on behalf of the whale, even if in our own lives we have never or we very rarely encountered them. Like everyone, you know, whether you live in a high-rise apartment or if you're a child reading your first alphabet book, like the letter W is nearly always a whale, that kind of compassion is sort of useful. And I think that that's where I drew my hope from in the book. But ultimately, I think the other part of it is that you don't get to feel hopeful until you make yourself useful. And this is another point that I make, that, you know, some people come to nature writing today looking for some place of reprieve, some retreat from modernity or from work or industry. I just don't think socially accountable nature writing can look like that anymore. Nature is not a place of refreshing spiritual reprieve anymore. It shows evidence of human activity. And I think knowing that, like, hopefully the book is a place to kind of consolidate your nerve and then in whatever local small way you can help, make yourself helpful. Because then when you make yourself helpful, you do feel hopeful. That's been my experience at any length.
Thank you. You've articulated that beautifully. I might just ask one more question, which is from Leslie, who has commented that they think that we find the history of whaling quite distasteful, but how much do you think that we should explore this history to confront our changing relationship with these magnificent creatures?
So much. I think, you know, the Australian history of whaling is fascinating. My mum is from the southwest down near Albany. So she remembers actually, you know, the whales being drawn up onto the forecourt there and flensed. Whaling in Albany finished in 1977, so before I was born, but, you know, still within her lifetime. The forecourt still stinks of whale fat. She has some wonderful stories to tell about local characters like beating back sharks with shovels as they fed off the carcasses in the bay. But the point is, we were the last English-speaking nation to continue whaling. But we were the first nation to make that pivot on the basis that whales were worthy of protection, not as a fishery stock, not as a resource to be exploited, but because the future generations deserve to live on a planet that hasn't been denuded of its largest animal. You know, we really made a very dramatic turnaround. And in this day and age where we're considering, you know, movement in our energy economy away from heavy fossil fuel extraction to clean energy, we're again facing like another kind of pivot. And what whaling teaches us is that it's not enough for the invisible hand of the market to kind of move the index. It has to be accompanied by cultural change. Because whales really were, you know, in the 19th century, they were the foundation of an extractive economy. So whale oil was used as a lubricant in machinery. It was also a really superior illuminant. So it went into candles that lit factory floors and extended trading hours into the nighttime. So it's really there at the beginning of the industrial workplace, the industrialized workplace. It sets off automation. It's also this amazing consumer good. So it goes into the baleens from the whale's mouth, which are kind of like a fibrous substance that some whales have in their mouths. That goes into sundry consumer products and gets turned into things, you know, from as varied as the hula hoop and the, you know, springs in watches and sofa stuffing. And, it, you know, in the same way that we live very proximately to plastic objects, our forebears lived in an environment that was furnished by whale-made objects. Yeah, and it really took cultural change for that shift away from reliance on whale products to take place. So we're again confronting that problem. We're again thinking about how do we generate cultural change to ensure that the environment we live in is not decimated and rotten for decades to come, hundreds of years to come. Yeah, sorry, that's a long-winded answer to you. Can I tell you my favourite whale?
Of course, please.
I wonder if I can find it in the book. My favourite whale is something called the strap-toothed beaked whale, which has markings a bit like a panda bear. It's black and white. And the males have these two tusks. So it has a snout a bit like a dolphin. And these two tusks grow out of its lower jaw and they slowly wrap around the upper jaw. So as the animal ages, it's only able to open its mouth smaller and smaller gape because these tusks are wrapping it closed, which means that they have to hunt like smaller and smaller squid, which they end up sucking up like noodles through the tip of their beak. Anyway, that's just my bid for like whales are wild and magic, and there are lots of quirky, weird whale facts in this book as well. So if you're the kind of reader in, who's interested in the strap-toothed beaked whale, then I'm going to put a bid for you to go out to your independent bookstore and pick up Fathoms.
Well, I think a whale slurping a squid up like spaghetti is the perfect image to finish this conversation on. Rebecca, thank you so much for making the time to be with us this evening. On behalf of Melbourne Writers Festival, I'd also like to thank our event partners at the University of Melbourne for collaborating with us on this special project. Extra special thanks to Associate Professor Sarah Wills for writing the wonderful expert reading guide. Thanks to Readings, our online bookseller. Rebecca, all the very best, and I hope that Fathoms continues to reach more readers in Australia and across the oceans.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.